Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, even Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Dave DeWitt, Managing Editor for News at WUNC, and I'm here with Jeff Tiberi, Capitol Bureau Chief. Hi, Jeff.
Hello there.
Today is a special edition of the WUNC Politics Podcast. After 13 episodes of insightful deep dives into the North Carolina political landscape, we've decided to branch out. We've invited someone who is not on our staff here at WUNC to join us, and we figured it was time to class up the joint and bring, what do you call it, expertise to the proceedings. Tom Jensen is the director of the Public Policy Polling, a national polling firm based in Raleigh. Tom, welcome.
Hey, good to be with you.
So let's start with the race for president here in North Carolina. Early last week, the PPP poll showed Clinton leading Trump here for the first time since March by 2 points. And late last week, a Marist Wall Street Journal NBC News poll showed Clinton with a 9-point lead. And I'm wondering, as these polls come out, and these are two pretty closely, at least from a timing standpoint when they were released, why the difference in a poll in those two polls?
It can have things to do with how the sample's sort of made up. So like how many African Americans you have versus white voters, how many younger voters you have versus older voters, that kind of thing. But I also think that when you have polls that have a margin of error of plus or minus 4%, it's actually sort of natural to have some differences like that. And I say, even as somebody who runs an individual polling company, that it is always best just to look at all the polls cumulatively, not just to pick out the one that you like, that kind of thing. Certainly saw a lot of Democrats with the Marist poll that had Clinton up by 9, sort of like, okay, we're going to win North Carolina, it's over. And then Republicans, which is unusual for us, saying, well, pay attention to PPP. They say it's still a toss-up. And I think it's best to look at them all together. And when you sort of look at that overall picture, it's a modest advantage for Hillary Clinton in North Carolina, but certainly still within the realm of competitiveness.
And as for the gubernatorial race, so I think your most recent poll shows Cooper with a 1-point advantage over McCrory, the incumbent. That's obviously within the margin of error. And then the Marist poll that came out a couple of days later, or within, you know, just a very short time period, has Cooper up 7. You mentioned Clinton. Where's the gubernatorial race at? I mean, based on what you've looked at with various polls, and where would you peg the Senate race at this point in mid-August?
I think the governor's race is still a complete toss-up. We've been polling it every month now for the last 20 months, and we have never found either Pat McCrory or Roy Cooper up by more than 3 points. Sometimes McCrory's up by a little bit, sometimes Cooper's up by a little bit, sometimes they're exactly tied, but I really think that like the governor's race is the definition of the phrase toss-up. That NBC Marist poll did have Cooper up by a little bit more, 7 points, but the last Civitas poll had McCrory up by 5 points. So again, I think when you look at them all together, it's a total toss-up. The Senate race, I think, certainly has gotten a lot more national attention this week because that same Marist poll had Deborah Ross up by a couple points. We've never found anything other than Richard Burr leading, but we've also never found Richard Burr leading by that much. We've consistently found Burr with something in the 2 to 4 point range lead. And every poll until that Marist poll last week had also had Burr up by a modest margin. So I still think of that as a race that leans a little bit towards Richard Burr, but it's not unfair to call it a toss-up either. It's somewhere in between a toss-up and leaning slightly towards Burr. So there's not another state in the country as intriguing this year as North Carolina, with every single race at the top of the ticket so competitive.
It strikes me, looking at all the polls, that the Senate and governor's race are similar to campaigns we've seen in the past, where the, you know, there might be some modest changes, but we don't see this sort of wild fluctuation. The president's race here and elsewhere seems different. It seems like there can be comments by one of the candidates and it sends polls going one way or another. Am I right about that? Do you see some wilder fluctuations in the present race?
Yeah, the presidential race has definitely been a little more volatile. And I think what it's a reflection of is the presidential race this year ought to be a 50-50 race. Like, history tells us that after you've had one party in the White House for 8 years, you're usually sort of open to switching to the other one. And I think that if Republicans had what you would think of as a replacement level candidate, just sort of an average quality candidate, this race would be at worst for Republicans a toss up. I think it would actually be leaning Republican if Marco Rubio or John Kasich or Jeb Bush or somebody like that had been the Republican nominee. The simple reality is that they nominated a well below average candidate, quite possibly the worst major party candidate for president ever. And that's why you have Hillary Clinton on balance with a decent sized lead. But the reason we see those fluctuations is because voters want to be open to voting for Republican this year, voting for change. So sometimes if Trump behaves himself for a few weeks, stays in line, you'll see voters start to say, okay, you know, maybe I can move more towards Trump. And then he insults the cons or gets in the fight with the Latino judge, that kind of thing. And they're like, back up, no, this person cannot be president. You'll see Clinton go back to a wider lead. So I really think the biggest variable there is sort of the extent to which Trump is staying in his lane or not. When he is sort of targeted and on message, it becomes a closer race. When he gets back off the rails, Clinton gets a bigger lead again. And who knows how many times we'll see that dynamic go back and forth again over the next 11 weeks.
Hmm. You all do polling here in North Carolina, also nationally, but in other states, other swing states. I think I've seen Pennsylvania, maybe Wisconsin, Ohio. Tell me about some of the other races that for you are top of mind or most interesting or worthy of chatting about at kind of this point.
Sure. Well, I think what's really interesting is that in a lot of the key presidential swing states this year, you also have really important Senate races that are going to determine who gets control of the Senate or not. I mean, I think at this point, it's sort of generally accepted that Hillary Clinton has over an 80% chance of winning the presidential race, but it's still about 50-50 when it comes to the Senate, and that's going to be very important in terms of determining what ends up happening with the Supreme Court vacancy. Do Democrats end up nominating somebody more ambitious than Merrick Garland, that sort of thing. Democrats need to win 4 Senate seats to get control of the Senate back. You have a couple that they are just definitely going to win, Illinois and Wisconsin, so that gets them within 2. And then you have a bunch of toss-up Senate races in states that are also toss-up presidential states. So North Carolina, Florida, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, Arizona is a swing state for both president and Senate this year. So those are the states that are most interesting to me, is all of those sort of traditional key presidential battleground states that are also the Senate battlegrounds that are going to determine whether Hillary Clinton, if she's elected president, has a Congress that she can really work with, or if we're just going to continue with the sort of gridlock that we've had the last couple years of having a Democratic president but a totally Republican-controlled Congress.
These days in elections, everyone gets painted with the partisan brush. The media are liberal elites. Fox News is right-wing propaganda. Pollsters are no different. PPP polling often is called Democratic leaning, but I was looking at 538 this morning and it said that you're actually leaning a little Republican. And I'm wondering, sort of, when you get accused of being one way or the other, you know, what is it about how you guys do polls that you think is an accurate representation of what the electorate is thinking?
Sure. Well, first of all, to explain why we're called a Democratic polling company, that's a perfectly fair label, because even though we're most known for the polls that we put out in public every week, we're predominantly a commercial polling company, and 90-95% of the surveys that we do are just for private clients who hire us, and we only work for Democratic candidates and for progressive-leaning issue organizations. So when it comes to our client base, there's no doubt that we're Democrats, but what pollsters are trying to do is just try to get it right, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. It doesn't do us any good to say that a Democrat's winning if they're not. So I think that's why the 538 analysis has found that over time our polls have been pretty neutral when you compare them to the final results. But anyway, our methodology, we use a combination of calling people on their landline telephones and then reaching people over the internet who don't have landlines. We don't call cell phones, partially because it's incredibly cost prohibitive, but also partially because even if you get somebody on their cell phone, they don't want to answer a poll. They might be at the gym. They might be eating dinner. There's all sorts of things that they might be doing when you reach them, as opposed to we do still like to call people on their landlines, because if we get you on your landline, it means that you're at home and you're answering the phone and you're not necessarily that busy. So we use the combination of those two things to try to be able to reach people in the way that they'd rather be reached in. And one thing that we do that I think is a little bit different from other polling companies is we really give people a lot of opportunities to answer the survey. So for instance, when we're doing a telephone poll, we'll call people six times over the course of 4 days to try to reach them at a variety of different times so that we're not just doing a poll of whoever happened to be at home on Thursday night when we called. If we call you Thursday night and you don't answer, we're going to try you again Friday. We're going to try you again Saturday. We're going to try you again Sunday so that if you want to answer the poll, you have an opportunity to do that as many times as possible. And with the online part of the survey, we send it out on Thursday afternoon. We just ask people to respond by Sunday night. And that's one thing that I really find appealing as the polling industry moves towards doing more surveying over the internet is there's so much more flexibility about answering it. If you want to get up in the middle of the night and answer a poll at 4 o'clock in the morning, you can do that as opposed to the sort of traditional phone polling where you get called at an exact time. And if you don't feel like answering it, then you might be out of luck.
Do you have a sense of how that flexibility skews the poll?
I think it actually sort of unskews the poll. Okay. We're getting into all sorts of these sort of modern polling terms. If you make a smaller number of attempts to call people, this is who you're going to end up getting very disproportionately. Old people, white people, women. Those are the people who are easiest to reach. It's harder to reach younger people. It's harder to reach Latinos. It's harder to reach African Americans. So that is why we end up making so many of those attempts, is to try to make sure that we're getting as many people in those harder to reach groups as possible. This has sort of been a smaller thing in 2016 than it has been in some past presidential elections. But like in 2012 and 2010, one of the big sort of issues in the polling industry is Rasmussen Reports was one of the most prolific pollsters, and their polls were always more Republican than everybody else, and people would get worked up about it and that kind of thing. And I think the reason that their polls were more Republican than everybody else is all of their polls were one night. They called you at 7 o'clock Thursday night, and if you weren't there to answer it at 7 o'clock Thursday night, you didn't get included in the poll. And doing it that way really biases it towards those people who are easiest to reach, who are in more Republican-leaning demographics.
And even with that offered flexibility, what percentage of people do not pick up the phone, never respond to
your... it's dreadful. Your response rate for a poll is about 5%. So wow. Dave mentioned that he recently answered one of my polls. I mean, I should have like brought him a cookie or something as a token of appreciation. About 1 in 20 people who we contact for a poll will actually answer it. So a lot of the time we're doing a poll with maybe 1,000, 1,500 people in it. That means we have to contact 20 or 30,000 people to get that many interviews. And a generation ago, 40% of people would answer a poll if they got called for it. But we just have so many more ways to entertain ourselves now, so many more ways to keep from talking to strangers on the telephone, that it is very hard to reach people. And I think that's why you're starting to see more of this flexibility in terms of polling methodology and more move online, because people just don't want to answer the phone from strangers anymore, for sure.
One other super specific kind of wonky question from me. Do you have any mechanism to keep people from being polled over and over again? Or, you know, if we see a PPP poll in July, August, from November of last year, is there a chance that, I don't know, Sarah from Wake County has been polled several times? Because, as you just said, you keep trying to get people.
When we do a statewide poll, we have a database of about 2 million phone numbers to pull from, and we'll pull a list of like 30,000 people. So you're not going to see a whole lot of people getting called for the same thing over and over again there. But when we do our private client polling, it's a lot less statewide stuff than it is polling a specific state senate district in Wake County or polling a specific county commissioner race in New Hanover County. If I'm polling a county commissioner race in New Hanover County, I have to call every single person who's in there to be able to get enough interviews. So if I'm doing another poll there again a month later, you are going to get called for it. And the place where we poll the most is Wake County, because you have so many competitive legislative races, county commissioner races, that kind of thing. And I'll run into somebody who's like, I've gotten pulled by you four times in the last month because of the low response rates. We have to really, in those sort of smaller areas, cast a pretty wide net. So yes, there are some people who I would sort of think of as professional poll takers.
Well, you mentioned I got a call. My wife was taking the poll. I was surprised by how many questions there were and how long it was. And we chatted about this before we came on, but you know, the poll is pretty, it takes a little while, but you mentioned how you construct the questions, how quickly is really important too.
Yeah, what we try to do with our public polls is we do ask a lot of questions. A lot of the time they'll have 50 or 60 questions because we're trying to cover so many different topics. But what we make sure with those is that they're very simple questions and that the poll sort of moves along quickly. When we're doing polls for private clients, a lot of the time the questions are more involved. It'll be like, candidate X says this about this issue, and then you read a paragraph. Candidate Y says this about this issue, and you read a paragraph. Which of these do you agree with more? If you're doing questions like that, that are like 200 words within a question, you have to keep the poll more to like 5 or 10 questions in that kind of case when you have the more complex questions. But what we usually find with a poll like the one you got called for is that once people get through the first 5 or 6 questions, as long as you're sort of staying with easy to digest questions and sort of keeping the poll moving along, once they've gotten into it, they'll kind of go through and do the whole thing.
I think it's time to ask about D's Nuts.
Yeah. So as we got the poll, I'm familiar with public policy polling. I'm waiting for the question as we get along. And because there's always one question in there that's at least one that's pretty interesting and somewhat different from other polls, it seems like. Jeff mentioned one was about, gauging the support for a candidate known as D's Nuts. Another one was the one that I got was Donald Trump mentioning that Hillary Clinton may be the devil. And the question was, do you agree with his assessment on that? Where do you get these questions and why include them in polls like this?
Sure. Well, a lot of the sort of offbeat questions that we've been asking this year are actually just Donald Trump says something crazy and we see if his supporters agree with it or not. So that was why we asked if his supporters thought that Hillary Clinton was the devil, because Donald Trump straight up said that and we found that 40% of his supporters agreed. That sort of thing was really important during the primary, though, I think, in helping to understand why every single time there was some controversy that the media thought was going to caused Trump's support to collapse, it was so resilient, was he was saying these crazy things, but his supporters completely agreed with them and they stuck with him because he was the only person willing to say things like that. So for instance, Trump repeatedly said this made up story about Arabs in New Jersey celebrating 9/11, and the press would be like, he's lying, he's making this up. We found that 70% of his supporters thought that that really happened. So that showed that, he was sort of speaking for this group of people who hadn't usually had a candidate before that spoke for them. But it also shows that there's an almost a cult-like aspect to his appeal where anything he says, his supporters just go along with it. So, for instance, one thing along those lines that I think is sort of a bigger deal right now is that Trump keeps saying that the only way he's going to lose is if the election's rigged. And we find that 70% of his voters agree with that. And I think that means that the aftermath of the election, assuming that Hillary Clinton does win, could get pretty ugly. So some of that stuff I think is very important in understanding the sort of psyche of the Trump supporter and why he has the kind of staying power that he does. Some of it is just to be silly, to speak specifically to the D's Nuts example. One thing that we do when we're putting together our polls that's sort of unique within the polling industry is we crowdsource the polls that we do publicly. We go on our website and we go on Twitter and we say, we're doing a poll in North Carolina this week. Do you have any question suggestions? And we actually end up using a lot of those. So last summer, somebody filed officially as a candidate with the Federal Elections Commission for president under the name D's Nuts. So we, that week we went on and took our question suggestions and people sent me the FEC filing and were like, test this candidate D's Nuts for president. So I was like, okay, sure. Why not? Did it. And it turned out that D's Nuts got like 10% of the vote. And it actually turned, I was initially just doing it because it was funny, but it actually turned into something that said something about the election, which is that the parties are heading towards nominating candidates in Clinton and Trump who are so historically unpopular that 10% would rather vote for D's nuts, which is about the most ludicrous candidate possible. So it's one thing to say that, you know, Clinton has a bad favorability rating and Trump has a bad favorability rating. It's another thing to say that voters are so disgusted with their choices that 10% of them would vote for D's nuts. So that's sort of – this has been a ridiculous presidential election. It's an election that's gone on forever. And sometimes in our polls, we just try to add a little bit of levity to it. So I'll give you a preview of something we're going to ask this weekend. Last week, this new independent conservative candidate for president, Evan McMullen, announced that he was going to run for president. And this guy is like a low-level congressional staffer. So the idea that he's a serious presidential candidate is kind of ridiculous. But he's from Utah. We're polling Utah this weekend, so we'll certainly include him on the poll. But anyway, Twitter got really into the fact that Evan McMullen sounds pretty similar to Sausage McMuffin. So on our Utah poll this weekend, we're going to ask, do you have a favorable or unfavorable opinion of Evan McMullen? And also, do you have a favorable or unfavorable opinion of Sausage McMuffins? And we'll see who comes out better in the poll.
That's great.
You mentioned a little while ago about 95% of the work you do is for, you know, candidates running. Mm-hmm. If you would, if there's something interesting to chat about, will you take us, I guess, behind the curtain a little bit? Are there, do you deal with, do you directly or do your staffers, do they talk to the candidates frequently, if ever? Have you ever ticked off a candidate? Are there surprising elements of kind of that relationship that, I don't know, we might be entertaining or might be interesting for us?
Well, first of all, the less interaction you have with the candidate, the better. It's not good news if the candidate's bothering you about their poll.
But have there been candidates
plenty. Okay. I would say the hardest part of it from a client perspective is somebody will come in and they're like a first-time candidate running for Congress or the legislature or something. In a lot of those cases, for us, it's somebody who's running in a district that's like Republican plus 20. And, you know, we'll do the poll and they'll be down by 25 points. And this person's so excited. They're running for office. They got their first ever poll. And you have to tell them that they have no chance of winning whatsoever. Like, that's one of the harder parts of the job. Something more interesting, I won't attach any names to this, but I've only really ever had to fire one client. And the reason I had to fire this client, he's a member of Congress, not from North Carolina, to be clear, and he's not going to be in Congress anymore next year, thank God. But he would call up and personally dictate how he wanted the polls weighted. He would be like, I want it to be 27% Hispanics, or I want it to be 33% African-Americans. And he was trying to drive up how well he was doing in the poll by having us use these demographics. And it was a situation where he was using the census numbers in his district to tell us what to do. But there's no relation at all between the census numbers and what the numbers among people who actually vote are. So, for instance, it's a district with a lot of Hispanic voters, but a lot of the Hispanic voters aren't U.S. citizens or they aren't registered. So they might be a third of the population in the district, but they're only going to be 15% of the vote. Of course, Hispanics tend to vote 2-to-1 Democratic. So if you have twice as many Hispanics as you should, the guy's going to be doing a lot better. So I just finally had to be like, we're not going to work with you anymore. This is insane. But it's like, this guy's a member of Congress and he's calling me up. One year he did it on my birthday, calling me up. I need you to switch the Hispanics to da-da-da-da-da. Like, no, this is not how it works. You hire us to give you the best approximation that we can and that sort of thing. So you run into some of that. It's sort of funny on both ends of it. I mean, sometimes clients argue with you because they think that they should be doing better than you found them doing. And sometimes they argue with you because they think you're doing you have them doing too well. So what I always tell people in that situation, you know, let's say they're up by 15 and they think they should only be up by 6 or 7. I'll be like, look, you know, at the end of the day, you need to run like it's tied or run like you're behind. Like, you should not, because we have you up by 15, say, okay, we won, this is over, I'm going to sit on my hands for the next month, that sort of thing.
Has there ever been a poll where, you know, whether it's internal or an external poll, where it was just, it was way off from the result and you just couldn't figure out how you were just so far off? Or that's got to happen every once in a while, doesn't it?
Yeah, it can be very frustrating. I mean, we actually did a poll this week in a legislative district in another state where Barack Obama won the district by 10 points in 2012, and we found Hillary Clinton trailing by 5 points in the district this week. So she was doing 15 points worse than Obama did in 2012. So the first thing I would usually look at with something like that is, well, is this a rural district where Trump did well in the primary and Hillary Clinton got blown out by Bernie Sanders? Because that might help explain why she would be doing worse there, even though she's doing better national overall. It turned out it was a suburban district, which is where we're tending to find Clinton outperforming Obama by the most. So it was something where it really just didn't make any sense at all. And I sent it to the client and I was like, you know, this is what we found and we have to tell you what we found. I said, but honestly, I do think that this is probably a little bit too much on the pessimistic side because none of this adds up with what we're seeing in the overall picture. And right now we're doing about 30 or 35 polls a week. And it actually is sort of just making my head spin because when you do 30 or 35 polls a week, you are going to have some that just don't make sense to you. And sometimes when things don't make sense to you, it's because there is something just going on that you wouldn't expect. I think that maybe the most prominent individual poll about something that was just totally serious that we've ever done was the 2010 special election for Senate in Massachusetts. Everybody expected that that Martha Coakley, the Democrat, was going to win by 15 or 20 points. We did a poll. I still remember everything about this. I was sitting watching the college football national championship game between Alabama and Texas that year, and I'd run the poll, and I hadn't even paid any attention to the poll, and I went in at 9 o'clock after the poll was running and just like casually looked at what had happened and the Republican was winning. It's like, oh my God, that can't, you know, possibly be true. In that case, it was. But sometimes when you see something that doesn't make sense and you just think it's crazy, it's because you're wrong. And when you do 35 polls a week, you know, one or two of them, you're probably just going to be off on. And that's something that's true for all pollsters.
Brief esoteric. So I'm from Massachusetts. That was Ted Kennedy's seat, right?
Yeah.
And so what I'm interested in was, I remember Coakley like went on vacation. Didn't she go to like Greece or the Bahamas or something? Was she ahead and then she blew that race? I mean, she didn't handle that race very well as a candidate.
She was up by 15 and she ended up losing by 5, and it really did fall apart for her in the last 2 or 3 weeks of the campaign. But it was actually sort of an interesting situation with the polls then. The Boston Globe came out with a poll with Coakley up by 15 on the same day that we came out with a poll that had Scott Brown up by 1. And for us as a Democratic pollster, is a weird day because we were just getting trashed by Democrats all day. It's like, well, the Globe has Coakley up by 15. What do you know? But it actually turned out in that case we were right. And certainly there have been cases where we were different and we were wrong too. But
do you ever gloat? You ever like go back and say, yay, how about that?
The older I get, the less I gloat. 25-year-old Tom probably would have gloated about that kind of thing a lot more than 32-year-old Tom.
Totally different note. The General Assembly,
sure,
where I spend a decent amount of time, more time, I guess, than I would like. Can you give me a sense of, or give us a sense, how many seats of the 170, 50 Senate, 120 House, how many do you deem competitive? And we've heard a little bit about the North Carolina House potentially losing its supermajority. I think Democrats would have to flip 3 seats to do that. What's your pulse on that?
I think there's a pretty good chance of Democrats picking up enough seats for that to happen. And I'll tell you where it will almost completely happen is within Wake and Mecklenburg counties. There's a lot of districts in Wake and Mecklenburg County that Mitt Romney won by 5 points in 2012 where Trump is just toxic. And we see Clinton up by 5 or 10 points in these districts that have traditionally been Republican-leaning. So one part of the problem for those Republican incumbents is Trump. The other piece of it really is HB2. I think when you think about HB2 sort of big picture, people think of it as it's so unpopular. And that's true to an extent. We find that only about 30% of voters statewide support it, only about and about 40% oppose it. So it's unpopular, but it's unpopular by like 10 points. I think the popular perception would be, especially in the triangle, that it's unpopular by like 30 or 40 points and that nobody likes it. And the reason for that perception in the triangle is that it is true that nobody likes it in the triangle, and it is true that nobody likes it in Mecklenburg County. So even though in the rest of the state, HB2 opinion is probably pretty evenly split, in Wake and Mecklenburg County and in these swing districts, it's unpopular by 30 points. So you take Trump, you add HB2, there's a lot of Republican incumbents who are going to lose in Wake and Mecklenburg County. I'll tell you two people right off the bat who I think there's almost no chance of them being back. One is Gary Pendleton in Wake County. I think he could end up losing by double digits. Charles Jeter wants to spend more time with his family. I'm pretty sure he had a poll that showed him down by 10 points before he decided to spend more time with his family. So those are two districts that I think Republicans are almost definitely going to lose. But then there's people like Nelson Dollar, Marilyn Avila, Chris Malone in Wake County, who could all possibly lose, that have not traditionally been thought of as that competitive. In Mecklenburg County, John Bradford, Rob Bryan, Bill Brawley are all people who could potentially lose, who you wouldn't have usually thought of them as competitive. So I think that Democrats do have a lot of good opportunities this year and really have very little to defend. I think the hardest seat for Democrats to defend is probably going to be, Lee County.
Okay.
Brad Selman. Brad Selman's seat will be hard because he was able to win simply because his opponent, Mike Stone, was so unpopular. But basically, big picture, Democrats have a lot of opportunities where things are looking good. Republicans have very little. So I think that Democrats will get it below 72. Senate is a harder, tough, harder road to hoe. And the Democratic money groups in North Carolina have generally decided to focus on the House over the Senate because there's so many more opportunities. Right.
This is probably a question that doesn't need to make the final edit of this podcast, but maybe it will. There's only one member of the General Assembly that is an independent, or was an independent, Paul Tyne of, he's up in the northeast corner. Of course, I'm going to forget the county now, not Currituck County.
Dare
County, yep. Thank you. Paul Tyne has resigned. I mean, he's not running for re-election.
Yeah.
District 6, I believe, is his district. Is that, what do you expect to happen in District 6?
I think it'll go back Democratic this year. I mean, one thing that's sort of interesting about Tyne is 2014, it's a rough year for Democrats nationally. Tyne still manages to get reelected as a Democrat still under those circumstances in 2014. So I think this year, in a better political climate for Democrats, that seat is likely to go back to them, and they also have a better candidate.
Tom, that's it for today. Really appreciate it. This is great. I really find this fascinating stuff.
Thank you.
Tom Jensen is the director of public policy polling, a national polling firm in Raleigh. Jeff Tiberi, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Jeff Tiberi is WUNC's Capitol Bureau Chief. You can subscribe to the WUNC Politics Podcast on iTunes and Google Play and follow all of the WUNC Politics stories on air and online. See you next week.